Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to the December 2024 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Forum Journal Club. Special thank you again to our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, for making it possible for us to be here together. Hard to believe that this is the last episode of the clinical side of 2024, but we have a special treat for you today. So I'm Dr. Remley Crow. I'm joined by Dr. Tony Fernandez, Jeff Rollman, Michael Caduce, and Dr. Bill Toon. And we have a treat. So instead of our usual format of one article, we've each picked one of our favorite articles of 2024, and we'll be walking through those. So get a lot more research crammed into one session. We're really excited to share it with you. This session will still be paired with an article in EMS World in Journal Watch. So this is authored by our very own columnist, Michael Caduce. Make sure to check it out. It'll be under the category of education and training at emsworld.com. And I wanna thank all of our listeners for joining here today. If you're here with us live, you know that you can use the chat or the Q&A feature to enter in questions and comments, and we'll bring those into the discussion with us as we go. And so without further ado, we can go ahead and jump into our first article. And it's like roulette, they don't know who's next, but first article up, let's go. Jeff Rollman, tell us about your favorite article.
Hello, everyone. Great to see folks here. And it's crazy to think that we're already into December. Where has this year gone? But I chose an article that was not in an EMS specific journal. This was in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, so focused on geriatricians. But it discusses a problem that we all know about in EMS, falls. So falls in most fire departments, most EMS agencies are commonly the number one call type, or if not number one, number two probably, are falls and lift assist. So we see a lot of falls, and we know that falls are a big deal. It's not just a matter of putting somebody back into bed. They are the leading cause of hip fractures, leading cause of traumatic brain injuries. They're the top cause of injury in general in the older population, and can have a lot of consequences, both financial and then loss of independence. So this paper described a study that actually used community paramedics, but used a unique telemedicine intervention. So the community paramedics weren't actually visiting their house. This was through telemedicine. And they identified patients that went to the ER for a fall, but then were discharged home afterwards. So 65 and older were discharged home, and they were found to be at high risk of falls in the emergency department. They used a standardized assessment based off of STEADI, and anybody who scored four or higher, that's kind of the standard benchmark, is considered high risk. So these were the folks who they knew they had to do something, or they were probably going to be back at the ER, back as a frequent flyer patient with another fall. They did exclude patients that were in nursing homes, or that were not in community settings, or folks with severe cognitive impairments. So if we could switch to the next slide, please. I think they did an awesome graphic. This is their first figure, just showing how this works. So who is involved? So first it starts off with that index visit. So to be included, they have to go to the ER for a fall or something fall related, not necessarily a fall injury. It could be something like dizziness that was potentially associated with a fall, was another potential inclusion criteria. And this program was made up of two specially trained community paramedics, two nurse care managers that were focused more on the discharge home rather than clinical care in the ER. And then this all got medical direction from one emergency medicine physician. So again, they included those that were high risk. And then they conducted a home visit within 24 hours. So if they're getting sent home within 24 hours of that discharge, they actually called them, and then they were able to facilitate this telehealth visit. So where the ER doctor was not there physically, but then that community paramedic was able to go into the home and use kind of like a FaceTime, essentially, where they were able to see face-to-face that ER doctor. And then the community paramedic was able to go through this standardized checklist. And then they did some assessments like the timed up and go test to look at balance. They did a mental status exam. They looked at home hazards, seeing if there were safety issues at the home. They did a very basic medication reconciliation. And then they looked at, again, trying to identify modifiable risk factors. So they included 104 patients. So if we go to the next slide, it describes that table one. So 104 patients were referred during this time period, and about 60% of them actually received that community paramedicine telemedicine visit. And then of those, 80% actually had a follow-up 2 weeks later, where they were able to see if this intervention, if they actually followed the recommendations of the intervention. And what were the key things that they found? If we could go to the next slide, kind of breezing through, but table two, this is going to show what was found in that initial home visit and then the follow-up home visit. So again, using this telemedicine where part of it is there in person with the community paramedic, and then we have that ER doctor who's assisting remotely. So they took orthostatic vital signs and found in about 11% of the population that they did have positive orthostatic, meaning that their systolic dropped by at least 20 or diastolic dropped by at least 10 millimeters of mercury. And that's something that we know is a fall risk factor. So they were able to give recommendations like changing some of their medications. But even more commonly were things like home fall hazards. More than two-thirds of these folks had fall hazards in their home that were recognized by that community paramedic. They also had sort of this abnormal timed up and go test, so balance problems. And then they were also able to make some referrals. So some people probably needed physical therapy, depending on maybe gait or balance impairments, or needed a follow-up with their primary care doctor. And interventions were suggested at really high rates. Some of the time, 100% of them were identified as having this issue, and then were able to get that intervention. And then we could see finally that follow-up visit, where 2 weeks later, that community paramedic said, "Hey, I gave you all these recommendations 2 weeks ago. What did you actually do with them? Did you do anything?" And we could see a dramatic reduction, that there's still some ongoing issues, but looks like a pretty significant drop in almost all of these categories. We saw a decline. So taking medications on the BEERS list, that's a list of very high risk medications that we know can contribute to fall risk. That almost dropped in half, from 36% of patients having high risk medications to 18% of patients having high risk medications. So it showed that this intervention that really was pretty straightforward with just having that paramedic and the ER doctor via telehealth, they were able to have a pretty big impact just in the span of 2 weeks. So what did we learn from this? We learned that really that telemedicine is something that community paramedics can use to help loop in additional assistance, like that ER physician who might be making recommendations on medications, for example, or getting an actual referral to specialty therapists. And it showed that these patients that are very high risk, we could do something about it. It's not just, old people are going to keep on falling, but there's nothing we could do. So I found this as something that's extremely promising, showing that we can, just in the span of these one or two visits, really have an impact. Of course, this was smaller, so just over 100 patients. This is based in the New York area, so I know that they talk about in their study next, they're trying to make a more wide-scale trial where this would actually potentially be a clinical trial where they could have a longer follow-up period and where they might have a bit more money to try to make more robust interventions. So I brought this study in since I thought it was an excellent way to describe a innovative community paramedicine program and how they were able to use telemedicine to really extend the reach of mobile integrated health.
Yeah, I think this is a great pick, Jeff. Really interesting view of the intersection between EMS and healthcare and public health. And I think this aligns well with some other articles that we've discussed this year. A recurring theme that I noticed as you were presenting is this, looking here even at table two, the Beers medication list. That's something I had never thought of clinically, you know, when I was in the field as an EMT, but it has appeared twice now in that there's an opportunity for EMS to help raise a flag and say, hey, there's a risk for this person in addition to the risks that are present in their homes. Might there be an alternative solution? And then that steady assessment has been used to assess fall risk in multiple studies that we've seen this year. And I think that's something for us to think about in the education space as we're developing our practice. Are there things when it looks like a simple lift assist, which I put that in huge air quotes for those just listening, because no such thing as just a lift assist is really important for us to do a full assessment. But I think incorporating some of the things that we've learned from these research articles could go a long way, such as taking the moment to perform some of these assessments and say, is there something else really going on here? We're best suited to see folks where they sit, right? Where they live. One other thing that I really liked about this article was they, in table one, listed whether an interpreter was used. And that made me think about this is a great potential opportunity. This use of telehealth is an opportunity to help close some gaps, some inequities in care. Thinking about patients who prefer a language other than English, thinking about folks who may not access the medical system in other ways. So this article does open up a lot of interesting ideas for interventions for patients who are at risk for falls. Thank you for picking it. And if any other panelists have comments or thoughts or questions they want to bring up, now is the time before I shift us to our next
I'm
one.
just going to share one more thing too. I forgot to
Please.
mention the authors. In addition to sharing their really cool pilot program, they actually shared in a supplement to the article, which I'm about to upload in a moment, all of their training materials, their slide deck, all of their resources. So they want you to take this home and replicate this in your setting. So I'm going to share this, but it was really amazing and very generous of the authors to publicly make available everything that they use to implement this.
Very cool.
So, Jeff, thank you. And I always suspect anything that comes out of New York just out of habit, you know, my history. But separate of that, the challenge, one of the challenges with something like this to me would be what would be the increased workload on the emergency department? You know, how, and I don't know if they address it in the article, is do the, you know, how do they address having a physician available to speak to these people, depending again, if it's in a New York City ED, they're fairly busy, you know, and they're not the only busy EDs that exist. So sometimes I like the idea, of course, of the using some form of video telemedicine to enhance the situation, but I wonder what the impact would be on the workload on the other end, particularly if they expand this a great deal. The other thing is really would be the would the right person to speak to, would it be an ED physician or would it be a gerontologist that would be better for them to be speaking with? You know, and just another point of view of, you know, where this can go down the road. But you know, since I am by definition a young geriatric, I'm have a heightened interest in everything in this area, because I know as time marches on, I'll be experiencing some more of these issues potentially myself. So I have a great interest in the what's going on in the geriatric field. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's something that I don't think was discussed in detail, but certainly, and this is similar to Jayance question. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. How much did this service cost to the healthcare system? What were the cost savings to the healthcare system? And this study did not include these details, but it noted that this was only the preliminary data. So they're still collecting more data and they're planning to probably publish that, I'm guessing, in a later study. So stay tuned. Very good question.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting concept too, because how, the concept of how do we fund these programs will come up. And in a previous article that we highlighted with the MedStar intervention in this population of they specifically looked at a group of patients who were classified as high utilization, and they ended up saving their healthcare system over $4 million. So the potential impact of these programs is very high, even though it was outside of the scope of this present study. Certainly something that as we implement programs like this and show how EMS can demonstrate its value has huge implications for sustainability too. And we do have another audience question, Jeff, I'll bring in for you from Justin. Do you know of any risk index that is specific to community paramedicine, assuming that refers to the falls?
I am not aware of anything that is specific to community paramedicine, but I would say the study risk, it's a 12 question. I believe it's 12 questions, and some of them are 1 point, some are 2 points. That's probably the most validated, and that's something that can definitely be used by community paramedics.
Yep,
So I'm
I would
gonna.
second that with the study risk, and it's STEADI, if you're looking that one up. It was also used in the previous article that we explored looking to intervene for patients at risk of falls. So, and both of these articles have used study in combination with those Beers criteria medications. Amazing work. All right. I know we've got a lot of research to cram into a short session, so I'm going to move us to our next one. And our next presenter is going to be Michael Caduce. Tell us about your article for the year.
Thank you, and what a great one by Jeff. In fact, Medicare and Medicaid oftentimes reimburse for medical, for fall risk assessments and for medication reconciliation because it does save us money in the long run. The best fall is the one that doesn't happen. So I'm thrilled to share a consensus statement that came out of the UK. And the reason I picked this is because of the very unique set of research that they did to get this. So I think sometimes when we think consensus statement, we think it's a bunch of people that get together and come up with and sort of what we can agree on. And this study did exactly that, but they actually proposed 10 different studies to come up with their consensus document, and that's how they come up with their recommendations. So on the next slide, we'll see a little bit about what they did to get to their consensus statement. So first they started, there's an organization out of the UK, and their goal is really to study all things related to motor vehicle collisions. And I'll put the document in the chat, but it talks a little bit about this systematic scoping review and then the EXIT project, which really looks at how do we save lives with motor vehicle collisions, similar to the UK and the US, it's a leading cause of trauma. So they put together a whole bunch of things. And again, their aim was how can we deliver great care to patients? And their focus on this one was this extrication component. And are we delaying care of patients with the extrication process? And do the things that we're doing during the extrication process really impact a patient? So really, really interesting to read all of the different studies that they put together. They did a couple of retrospective reviews of data out of the UK Trauma Registry, looking at what is the incidences of patients requiring extrication, what is the incidences based on gender and age of patients having a high mortality rate following extrication. And then they designed several biomechanical studies looking at the amount of cervical spine flexion motion with a cervical collar during extrication. They looked at actually part of the extrication process and is there injury to the person by moving vehicles within the extrication process. So I think sometimes we cut the car out to get the patient, whereas sometimes you could move the other car to get the patient out. So they looked at all of this stuff. And then they ended their 10 studies by asking people that were their volunteers that were extricated what they thought and asking responders what they thought. So that gets them to 9 studies. And then their 10th study was this consensus meeting where they brought in stakeholders from all of the different trauma organizations and EMS in the UK and said, like, okay, what does all of this research look like? And what does it say? And what can we agree on? And that's the next slide, which is some of, I pulled all 14 of their recommendations. Some of these make a lot of sense and actually like make you think a little bit about the US extrication process. It's probably worth noting there's a little bit of a difference in who responds to a motor vehicle collision in the UK. You get a fire brigade and EMS, and the fire brigade may or may not be clinically trained. So you'll see in here they talk a little bit about using some tools for those that are non-clinically trained. So may or may be similar to our US system, but a little bit different. It's a couple of the highlights that I take. One, they'd say that all patients that are involved in an extrication should be considered sort of like critically injured or considered time dependent. I think this is something that we sometimes overlook. If the patient's mechanism of injury was so severe that they're requiring the car to be taken apart around them, we should consider them to have a high suspicion of severity in the patient. So that was their first one. The number two's recommendation was non-clinical. Non-clinicians should be empowered to decide on the extrication mode and deliver this before the clinical team arrives. Again, if the fire department's arriving on scene before EMS is getting there, we're delaying the extrication process if they're being told to stay in their vehicle. I think we do this in the U.S. quite a bit too. We're worried about cervical spine injuries, so we tell the patient stay in your car and wait until EMS gets here, when really we probably don't need to be doing that. At least that's what their evidence would suggest. Number three was self-extrication or minimally assisted extrication should be the standard first-line extrication for all patients who don't have contraindications. They should review some of those contraindications, and I've got, they made a job aid, which I've got in here after our recommendations. It's pretty straightforward. It says if the patient can move their legs and that they're conscious, then they should be assisted out of the car if they can't get out of the car themselves. And so I thought that was really unique. It's a very simple, straightforward checklist. We'll get to a few of the things in here that talk about spinal motion restriction and holding cervical spine mobilization that may just stir the pot a little bit. But in essence, they're saying if the patient can move their legs and can walk without assistance, or they should be able just to self-extricate themselves out of their vehicle. Number three is Number four is self-extrication decision making for non-clinical providers should use a tool, something. They note this "you step out," which is actually really neat, and I'll show you what it looks like here before we're said and done. Five, patients who cannot independently self-extricate may benefit from assisted self-extrication. This is what we do on a lot of calls when you walk up and the patient's in their car and you say, can I help you get out? And it's literally just providing them an arm to get out or helping them get out of their car. I think sometimes we overlook that. This is not putting them in a headboard and trying to maneuver them out of the vehicle. It's simply asking them if you can help them get out of the vehicle. And again, the indications for this are like, can they move their legs and are they conscious? So quite simple. The recommendation number six on the next slide is in fully conscious patients who do not have neurology, it is not necessary to provide manual inline stabilization in the vehicle. This is one of my favorite recommendations here. More research obviously needed before we all stop holding C-spine, but the thought is if you can literally get in the vehicle to hold C-spine, what's preventing the patient from getting out of the car? Again, in an unstable patient or a sick patient who's just experienced this mechanism, why are they not getting out of the car by themselves? And if we're having to take the time to get in the car to hold manual stabilization, it's only leading to more and more injury to severity to the patient and delayed time of arrival to the hospital. Seven, if hard neurologic signs are present on initial assessment, the patient should be rapidly extricated with gentle patient handling. The paper goes into a little bit about what hard neurologic signs are, but it's most of the signs and symptoms that you would expect. Things like a patient's unconscious. If they're unconscious, they're likely not protecting their airway. And then rapid extrication is necessary for your patient. And then C-collars reduce neck movement. They should be applied prior to extrication when indicated and removed when the extrication phase is complete. So I thought this was a really interesting part of it. We've made this big shift over the last two decades on backboards and using them as extrication boards rather than long backboards. And this study is saying that unless there's some indications, which they note in the paper, the C-collar is really not necessary while the patient's lying on the gurney. And some of this came out of the biomechanical research they did as part of the study. So they put people in C-collars and extricated them and then just told people to hold still and extricated them with their gentle movement, and then measured the amount of restriction the C-collar provided. Number nine, vehicle relocation, including vehicles in which the patient was entrapped, should be implemented to reduce entrapment time. I thought this was interesting. I think like the T-bone accident's probably a good one, where the driver's sort of like between two vehicles. You could just move the other car as opposed to trying to get the patient up over the center console, out through the passenger side. They noted several different examples in the paper of where they tried this, and it really didn't cause a lot of, it didn't, you know, harm the patient that was in the car that was being moved. They mentioned a couple of them as like as simply as like just releasing the brake on the car and letting it roll back slightly so that they could get better access to the door of the patient's car. I thought that was interesting. And then number 10, rescuers should be aware that clinical observations may prolong entrapment time and consequently should be kept to a minimum. The paper talks a little bit about like starting IVs and doing thorough detailed assessments in the car. One, very difficult to do in a setting where a patient's seated in a car, but all that's doing is delaying our time to get the patient to the hospital when most of those interventions are probably not effective in actually helping the patient either. The next slide has 11 through 14, which are the final recommendations, which are clinical care during entrapment should be limited to necessary clinical interventions to expedite safe extrication. So again, the things that we're doing in the car, they actually noted a few of them in the paper that they had found that were time critical and important. Pelvic binders is number 12, and it's indicated that it should be done after the extrication is complete. Can't sort of fathom in my mind trying to put a pelvic binder on a patient seated in a vehicle. That seems complicated, trying to get it sort of like under their pelvis. But yeah, it seems easier when they're supine on a gurney. And then the psychological impact of extrication should be considered and support mechanisms should be implemented. They make a recommendation similar to having like an extrication buddy. So the person talking to you, helping you get out of the car is sort of like your buddy throughout the care. And so it's not five or six people from the fire department and the EMS all trying to talk to you, but really trying to make sure that we're minimizing that communication with the patient to one person. And then the fire brigades and ambulance trusts should ensure regular joint multidisciplinary learning, sharing, and reviewing of opportunities, which is the recommendation that we see in lots of these big Delphi studies where lots of people get together. We need to continue practice and training. So the next slide has a couple of the pictures of their job aids. So this is the self-extrication tool that they use, or U-step. In essence, if you can understand and you can move your feet, then it's recommended that they just have the patient step out of the vehicle, or they assist taking the patient out of the vehicle. So overall, I picked this consensus statement because it included their own research. They actually put together and planned some trials and did some meta-analysis data to really look at how are we doing in the extrication realm of the world. And I also just like research when it sometimes stirs the pot a little bit. And I think this whole just get the patient out of the car and stop holding C-spine is a very interesting topic that we're going to continue to learn more about.
Another very cool article, and I like that this one had so many components to it. And sometimes the consensus statements and things are not always making their way to the front line. And so I think this is a great way to do that. Really like the you step out mnemonic there. That's very helpful and probably a little bit counterintuitive to some of the things some of us were taught early on in our career. So really like how they're challenging the things that we know with actual data and evidence and designing the studies to answer the questions that needed answered where there wasn't data.
Yep.
Dr. Toon, I see you've got some thoughts.
I had only become familiar with this after listening to the podcast called The Resuscitation mm-hmm. Room, and they talk about this well. So if you're not familiar with that podcast, it's a great podcast that comes out of the UK, and it's worth listening to their take on it. If nothing else, the accents make it interesting in some of their colloquial language that they use. But this, as I'm sitting here listening to you say, it just makes me think full circle compared to what I started doing in 1975 compared to what's now. In 1975, we didn't do a lot of stuff with the C-spine. And then the early 80s and 90s came along and we went crazy. And then now we're back to maybe a little bit more of a balance. So, you know, if you do this long enough, you can actually see those cycles happen. So nice article. And again, it came out from a good group of people that if you've never listened to that podcast, it's worth doing. I put that link out in the show notes.
I'm looking forward to listening to it just for the access. No, definitely for the research too. I do think it's interesting how the pendulum has swung and watching the evidence develop. We don't have to chase our patients around and grab their heads and tell them don't move. That's probably for the better. And I think another area where we'll see this start to evolve and maybe start to reach some of the US practice is around the C collar. I thought that finding in per or that recommendation in particular was very interesting. You can use it as an extrication device and consider taking it off, where here we know some of the consequences for that. If we don't have the appropriate relationships with our trauma centers, you might get yelled at for doing something like that. And lots of debate too on hard versus soft collars and what's the right thing to do for patients. So I suspect that we'll continue to see this evidence evolve in 2025 and beyond.
Absolutely, absolutely. Makes you think about all the things we used to tell you in initial education, the patient's going to move their neck and be paralyzed for life. The evidence doesn't seem to be bearing that out quite as much as we used to talk about it.
No, it's the ones that we don't suspect is what the evidence is starting to
Yep.
push towards of the person who fell in their garage,
Exactly.
versus this, MVC, where if the person feels like they can get out, maybe let them get out. I think that's an interesting and important concept.
Yep, as opposed to us trying to finagle them out with a backboard and a CED and all of that kind of stuff, when all we're doing is moving their neck and back even more. So, and a
Yeah.
great question for Jayant in the chat as well, about did they look at like were there injuries? This study made the recommendations, and they note in their consensus statement that there are organizations doing this, and they've seen some big like wins where the patient made it to the hospital with a life-threatening condition. Did they look specifically at this? No, but there are several good papers out there that have looked at with the changes in spinal motion restriction, are we seeing incidences and injuries in patients? And everything I'm seeing says they're not seeing that.
Yeah, and I think this is an area where having that hospital outcome data is going to become important. And what was once a real magical, mythical unicorn is now becoming more and more commonplace. So I think we'll be able to start to ask and answer some of these questions. And in one of the recent research forum events that we hosted, which if you haven't visited prehospitalcare.org, there are lots of those research workshops. I'll take a moment to plug them. But in one of those 3-day workshops, a team actually took on the hospital data and said, how often are we even seeing surgical or cervical spinal injuries that were diagnosed at the hospital? And the answer was they were pretty rare. And in most of those narratives that they reviewed, the patient already presented with the signs of a neurological deficit, wasn't likely caused by the packaging or the transport. So I think that as we get more and more facilities on board with data sharing, we'll be able to study these questions because it is a rare event where we do need to pool our data in order to answer this kind of a question.
You mean we don't pith ourselves by just turning our head to look at
I mean,
you?
we could be the ostrich in the sand. No, that's absolutely, definitely an area where we could challenge the what was a common sense idea, but we can challenge those common sense ideas with data.
And
Exactly.
just so you know, I've been looking a lot, I'm trying to actually in my little trip down the history lane. But I did find out early on, like in the late 1800s and early 1900s, the recommendation with spinal injury patients was to put them gently on an air mattress, which I thought was very interesting at the time because they knew they didn't want to have let them have a rough ride.
And that's where we're talking about vacuum splints reminds me now, okay, the evidence is can we cushion instead of slipping them on a very slippery board where you wiggle around no matter how hard I tie you down? So definitely interesting to hear that maybe those ideas have been around prior to those devices. All right, I think we've got two more articles to get through in this exciting episode, packed full of articles. Next up is me. I'm going to step outside of my clinical comfort zone. So this article struck me as incredibly interesting. I heard Josh Kimball present it at NAMSP as an abstract, and kudos to him and the team for taking it all the way through to peer-reviewed publication. It's not an easy feat. But this article is looking at false electrical capture in patients who had transcutaneous pacing. And this is a case series. And I think it's important to highlight case series are often the foundation of the research pyramid from which we generate hypotheses and we decide where we're going to invest our time and resources into further studies. And this is definitely one of those studies that makes us go, there might be something to see here, folks. Perhaps we should do more research in this space. So, the article again is looking at transcutaneous pacing, which is a standard that's recommended by the AHA for patients with unstable bradycardia. And although this is an AHA recommendation and things that we should be doing, there have been reports from the frontline clinicians, the paramedics, that, hey, I think we're getting some false capture here. And what we're supposed to be doing to check for false capture is check for blood pressure and being able to feel the palpate, the pulse. So the objective that Josh Kimbrell and his team came up with was to describe the frequency of true electrical capture, the converse of the false electrical capture, and the verification of mechanical capture in association with systolic blood pressures and ultimately neurointact survival. And so this was a retrospective case series of patients who were treated within an urban-based, hospital-based system. And this was, again, in the New York area. We're really representing New York today. This study took place from March 2021 to March 2023. The inclusion criteria were adult patients who had a heart rate less than 60 and where transcutaneous pacing was attempted in the pre-hospital setting. The primary outcome measure that these authors looked at was true electrical capture, which they defined as the presence of visible wide QRS and T waves. And this was con this study, the review of these EKGs was performed by two paramedics. So I really like this article because it's showing us the importance of frontline raised a concern, frontline doing the research on this concern to help us know where to target more research resources. And I'll skip straight through to the punchlines because I know that we have a lot to get through today. But out of the 57,000 patient transports that occurred during the study period, 23 patients met the inclusion criteria. And right off the bat, that tells us this is something that is probably low frequency, but could be high criticality, but something worth looking at. The median age of these patients falls in line with what we would expect for this population, with the median age at 73 years old, slightly more male predominant, 61% were male. And then table one is our traditional demographic characteristics, but you can see table one already kind of spills the punchline with the true electrical capture out of these 23 patients was 4, and then false electrical capture being present in 19. And comparing the characteristics between these, can see that there's a slightly even more male predominance in the true electrical capture group. Though with these small numbers, again, and the authors are very good at being transparent and clear about this, is that these are descriptives only. We're not going to do a ton of statistical testing. And again, small numbers, a single change, one patient could make a big difference in the proportions that we're seeing. But I do think that this is a first finding right off the bat, very interesting that only 4 patients had true electrical capture. Then I'm going to push us over here to table 2, taking a look at again the treatment characteristics for that group who had the true electrical capture and the group that had the false electrical capture. Obviously, some of the things that we would suspect that there was CPR present in many of these patients, IVIO access, and then the medications that were given. This is probably my favorite figure in the paper, and yes, I'm a nerd that has a favorite figure. I know Jeff Jarvis would really like this figure too. This is a violin plot, and what a violin plot is essentially looking at the distribution of a continuous variable and telling us where the most patients are. Probably those of you who've listened to this podcast before know how I feel about averages. Averages can often be misleading. But these authors did a really great job at looking at the right kind of statistics for data that is not normally distributed. They use the median here. And this was one of their big outcomes, looking at the change in systolic blood pressure based on whether or not there was true capture. And perhaps unsurprisingly, but important to put the data behind, patients with true capture saw a much greater median increase in the systolic blood pressure. In this case, the systolic blood pressure for true capture, the median increased by 40 millimeters of mercury versus in the false capture group, there was actually a decrease of 1. So this is again a really great visual display of data that's not normally distributed. We can see that that blue group, the true capture group, the systolic blood pressure increase was much higher. And then in table three, we start to get into the rest of the study outcomes. Now, for the patients who they were able to get the outcome data for, again, this is just reiterating the importance of treating EMS as part of the care team, flowing the data back in a bidirectional way. Of course, the hospital would get the EMS data, but making sure that EMS is also able to access the hospital data. That's a soapbox I won't get off of anytime soon. But here's what we see for the patients where there were data. Of those who had the TrueCapture, two of them survived to admission, and one survived with a favorable neurological outcome, a CPC score of 2. Of the 14 patients for whom there was outcome data who had that false capture, 10 survived to admission, but none of those patients ultimately survived to discharge with a good neurological function. So here again, this paper really makes us think about, well, what do we do if we have the false electrical capture? There really aren't many options for us, but detecting it and raising awareness is the first step, perhaps, to designing some interventions to change this. The next thing, and I highly recommend that those of you who are listening take a look at the full article here. There are a lot of great dives, especially in the discussion, into the individual cases. So they show the EKG strips for several of the patients and showing some of the areas where the false capture was detected. And something that they highlight here in figure two is a phantom complex where artifact was actually mistaken as electrical capture. But this is one of those articles, again, I think it's thought-provoking. It really makes us say, hey, there's something to see here. We should be digging in with further research in this space. And this has a real implication for patients with that. If we're getting false capture, we're probably not actually doing the thing that we sought to do with the pacing in the first place. So I will click through these graphics, but highly encourage you all to check them out and open it up for other comments from our panelists. And even the appendices here are very interesting. Highly encourage you to check those out too.
I think great article, Remily, and this one got me thinking too of normally we consider a pulse check to be the sort of definitive measure for confirming bradycardia, the capture with pacing for bradycardia. And maybe we should change that to something like blood pressure, or maybe Dopplering a pulse on the feet or something like that. I did on one of the tables. I thought it was interesting. I think sometimes we talk about the milliamps to capture is like 70 for a rate and 70 milliamps. But the people that had true capture, it was higher than I was like the average was 85. And I think 80 was the lowest they went all the way up to 110, whereas the average was 70 in the false capture group. So makes you think too, maybe maybe we're not teaching the right dosage of milliamps or of joules, and that those things need to go up in order to get good capture. So makes you think this sort of seems like one of those low frequency, high risk patient procedures based on the outcome data that was shared. So makes me think that maybe this is one of those things, just like advanced airways, that we need more training on, not less. And maybe that would increase the number of people that are, successfully getting capture.
Absolutely. And speaking of dosage and joules, and a great comment in the audience from none other but V. Tanner Smita, talking about that. Josh Kimbrell also has a multicenter study going on and enrolling. And multicenter is really helpful when we have something like Michael just mentioned that's a low frequency, high criticality event. So exciting to hear that. And I know that Tanner also has research in this space with transcutaneous pacing. So one thing I can say is that I'm pretty sure our future is very bright between Tanner and Josh leading the way here. So very excited to see this next round of research, and we'll be sure to keep our eyes on it. And those of you listening, this is an area where the research is likely to evolve in the next year or so. So definitely keep an eye out on what's to come. Dr. Toon.
I'll do two things real quickly. One is it would be interesting to know where the pad placement was. Was it anterior, posterior, or anterior, lateral? I think that would be a real big factor for future stuff. And I'm sure maybe somewhere in their stuff they have that. But the other thing this brings me back to, and I think that understanding false electrical capture has to do with ECG competency. And I think that I've been unable to find in the education literature, what is the minimum competency that a paramedic should have for interpretations of ECGs? Not just rhythms, but 12 lead, and find actually, okay, you can only graduate from this course when you're capable of doing this 90% of the time. And once they get out, who knows what's done. Some stuff we did internally when I was in Kansas, it was very dismal. And most stuff dropped off after 3 months. So it was pretty, it helped us think about how we do, but what's the minimum? I don't think there's a minimum out there. If someone can point me in the right direction, that would be great.
Definitely things for us to consider as our education and our continuing education evolve. So again, a really great thought-provoking article. Kudos to Josh Kimbrell and the team on this one. Plenty more for us to keep our eyes open for as well. And why not one more hot topic for this annual edition of the top articles of the year, or favorite articles of the year, however we're going to call this. But I'll turn it over to Dr. Fernandez, who's going to take on a big topic here with resuscitation for patients with severe trauma.
Well, hello all, and thanks for some time today as we wrap up our final journal club of the year. Oh, I do see that it is evident that one of my New Year's resolutions should be to find a new picture for our podcast. We'll go ahead and make that a reality next year.
What? You look exactly the same. I don't know.
Exactly the same. Yeah. So as we move through, I'm going to talk about something that was also really interesting. I picked this for a couple of reasons. One, not just because the research was interesting, timely, and important, was also because, as you can see, this is not a traditional EMS journal. And I love that in a journal that is not a traditional EMS journal, we have a paramedic author with their credentials listed in the author list. I love this, and we'll move forward and see there are multiple reasons why I love this study. So we all know by now, I think, particularly those who watch this podcast regularly, early and effective resuscitation with blood products in a fast-paced urban setting could improve mortality. Blood in pre-hospital environment works. We know this from multiple studies, not just in the military setting, but more recently with research that has been done on EMS in a civilian setting. As we move forward, the author stated that at the time that this was published, there was no previous civilian pre-hospital studies within an urban EMS system that looked at mortality and related that to the timing of the first blood administration. So they wanted to move forward, and the purpose of their article was to analyze this and to see if the timing of the transfusion had an effect on mortality for patients. They looked specifically at patients who were victims of penetrating trauma. To include these patients, they had to, and we're going to stay on this slide for a second before we get to their hypothesis. To be included, the patients had to have a systolic blood pressure less than or equal to 70, or systolic blood pressure less than or equal to 90, with a heart rate that was greater than or equal to 110. They also had to have received at least one unit of blood to be included in this study. And as we move to their hypothesis now, they hypothesize that they'd see survival benefits among patients with severe hemorrhage when the blood was administered within the first 15 minutes of EMS patient contact. So we'll move forward to, they have a nice flow chart here. They looked at, they tried to look at 1,500 patients that were evaluated to be part of this study. As you can see, there were some patients that were excluded over to the right there, and they ended up with 143 patients that met their inclusion criteria. So there were 82 controls, and the controls were actually patients that were from 2016 to 2019 that met all the inclusion criteria, but before they started delivering blood. They also looked at the patients who did receive blood in the intervention group. These were patients who received blood based on the Advanced Resuscitation Care Bundle. For those who are not familiar with the Advanced Resuscitation Care Bundle, this is two units of packed red blood cells, calcium, and TXA. So that's what the patients who were in the intervention group were supposed to receive. So as we move forward, let's look at table one. This is an important table. I meant to make this bigger, but it looks like it still might be a little small on the screen. So I'm just going to pull you to a couple things that are important here. The overall demographics were very similar. There were there was a slightly higher percentage of African Americans in the control group. But again, don't just look at these p values on the left. Let's make a determination if the percentages are clinically relevant, right? And we're comparing 84 to 84. So again, p values can't always drive this. But there are some important changes that you will see, or in particular when we look at arrival to scene, when we look at the systolic blood pressure in the emergency department, the heart rate in the emergency department, and the shock index in the emergency department. All those were statistically significant differences, and in the way that we'd like to see if this bundle was actually delivered. So as we move forward, let's talk about a little bit of what they found. So this graph right here is looking specifically and only at the total time to not just to from the 911 call to the trauma bay, right? So you have a 7-minute response time in the on top here. This is our intervention group. So you have a 7-minute response time in the intervention group. You have an 8-minute scene time and a 10-minute transport time. If you look on the bottom here with our control group, all of those are very similar. We have a 6-minute response time. We have a 6-minute scene time and a 7-minute transport time. So the total time interval, right, the total pre-hospital time is about 5 minutes longer. But let's take a dive into this, right? The scene time, where you'd actually deliver the intervention here was only 2 minutes longer. For some reason, the intervention group experienced a slightly increased response time and a slightly increased transport time. And the authors actually list this as a limitation. They don't know why this happened. So while that is a statistically significant result in 5 minutes, that may be clinically important. Let's look at that scene time. That's only 2 minutes. And it led to some really important results. So if we move to the next graph here, we'll see that, and again, this is the same graph that we just looked at, but look at the time to the first unit of blood. So we have a time to the first unit of blood was 8 minutes in our intervention group. That same time to the first unit of blood was 26 minutes in our control group. That is a huge difference, and it was related to a huge difference in hospital mortality. Whereas you can see our intervention group, 7% mortality, our in-hospital mortality for the control group was almost 30%, and that is a statistically significant finding. So blood, we have plenty of research now that shows that we can, when deliver blood in the pre-hospital environment safely, and it is effective. And now we have some research that shows that it's timely and it helps patients survive. It looks like this is a pretty important intervention. But they didn't just look at these times. The authors went one step further. They built an adjusted regression model, and we'll move to this table now, where they adjusted for other important things. They didn't just look at time to blood administration with blinders on. And even after adjustment, they found an 11% increase in patient survival, I'm sorry, in mortality for every minute delayed in blood administration. So your chances of survival decreased by 11% for every minute that that blood is withheld. That is huge. So I thought this was a really important paper. Again, I love the author group, and that it's not in a traditional EMS journal. And I think that we should take these results. And of course, there's an upfront cost with administering blood. Of course, setting that system up is not easy, but there are more and more resources throughout our community that will help interested systems that want to start a blood program. There are plenty of resources for that now, and it works. We're seeing everything that we look at see is showing that it works pre-hospitally. So I hope that we take this information to heart.
I think this was a fabulous pick, Tony. This article makes us think too. It's such an important population being studied here. So patients with penetrating trauma, historically terrible outcomes, and showing the reduction in hospital mortality for this group was huge on that graphic that you displayed. Another thing to commend the authors on for this one is the choice of the control group. It is extraordinarily hard to design these observational studies, because if I just compare patients who got blood to patients who didn't get pre-hospital blood, it'll look like blood kills everybody, because patients who got blood were way sicker. But they were very smart in their selection that these patients received blood at the trauma center. And so they were in, but they had the vital signs that showed they would have been eligible pre-hospitally. That's a real key consideration in designing these observational studies. And you might say, well, why don't we just do an RCT? At this point, I'm not sure it's ethical to do an RCT. Should we be denying patients' blood if it was available? I don't
That's
think
a
that we,
point.
I think we have evidence to say that would not be ethical at this point. So really great piece, and glad you picked this one, Tony.
I was going to say the same thing. This is great, really interesting, and just that that time frame. The next thing I was my question is like, so what's the delay in the hospital too, right? If we can give this in the pre-hospital setting, certainly we know it's like, I'll get the patient registered, get the information. But there seems like there's also got to be a capacity for like an alert, like we do for STEMIs and strokes. We've started blood, or we think this patient meets the criteria for blood, so that it's at the bedside when they get there. I mean, every minute is 11%. We can probably fix the hospital side too, especially for some of these systems that will hear that they don't want blood in the pre-hospital setting because it's such a short transport time. Sure, but there's still a huge delay here. What can we do to make sure that the blood is at the bedside by the time the patient arrives at the hospital for those systems? So great, great paper. Love it.
Dr. Toon.
I will choose to continue to have a healthy degree of skepticism about the role of blood. Now, does it make sense? Absolutely. On face value, you know, blood carries oxygen, yada, 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 yada. But there was more to their bundle that they had here than just the blood. And I think that's an important aspect of it.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if people are looking for the bad side. They're enjoying, you know, the hype on this. There's a lot of hype on this that I don't know if people are digging into. Is there a downside? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. But I will choose to keep a healthy degree of skepticism. I want to see larger numbers. I want to see more study. You know, I think there's important. And from everyone I've heard, the biggest thing I've ever heard is the logistical aspects of it. You know, it's a big logistical haul. It's what the blood delivery problem isn't the issue. Once you get, you know, it's all the logistical setup that you need for it. And that's going to depend. And you know who I'd like to really see this? The group that is almost always never gets the benefit. Rural EMS.
Absolutely. And that's a great point, because the time saved here in an urban setting is much less than what could be saved in a rural setting. So it's certainly not to leave them out, but the logistical considerations remain a challenge, and reimbursement and sustainability, huge things for us. And I'm sure we'll see as the national coalition on this progresses next year. This is another topic to keep an eye on as we go forward. And I think healthy skepticism is how we should approach research. So I appreciate you bringing it up and bringing up the questions. We shouldn't just go in blindly excited about something. Excellent.
And one last thing, as we do move forward in this, I think it's very important that, guess what? I thought, you know, I just had a senior moment. I will get off because I know we're at the end. I can't remember it.
And I'm sure it will come back. Jeff, I'll let you have the last word on this paper, and then I will take a question. I'm going to take us out.
I was just going to say that healthy skepticism is a good thing, but at the same time, we have been seeing similar results in San Antonio. I'm fortunate to also work in a system that has very similar pre-hospital whole blood program, and it's a little bit longer with that scene time and the responses, but we found that it's very important that we have this protocol. We know our logistics, and in certain circumstances when these patients absolutely need whole blood, but it's going to delay things by too far, they don't get whole blood. They only get the whole blood or some sort of blood transfusion when it's able to be done efficiently without significantly delaying care. And then wanted to also put in a link, don't mean to sort of advertise at all, but for our sort of regional whole blood program in San Antonio, that this logistics issue, even in rural areas, is something that's been talked about, but it works even in rural areas. An hour and a half outside of San Antonio in the middle of nowhere, they've been able to get whole blood and make it work. So there's more information at that link that I included in the chat, and looking forward to seeing more research to prove this.
Definitely more research, and thanks for sharing your experience in a system that is currently practicing this. I think it's definitely a topic for us to keep eyes on and to keep the rural setting in mind. And with that, I'll bring in the last comment from the audience around considerations for drone delivered pre-hospital blood. I think we haven't seen it yet. There's been a lot of talk and a lot of modeling on drone delivery, but there's also some logistical and some legal considerations with FAA and all of those. And we've had Dr. Sheldon Cheskas from Canada come on and talk about some of the drone models. So I think that is another area to keep an eye on too. And what a perfect thought for us to continue into 2025 with. But I know that we have reached the end of our time, and I want to thank all of our panelists for all of their contributions all year long. What a year it has been for EMS research. It just keeps getting better. And for those of you in the audience, thank you. Those listening later on, thank you. Look forward to having more excellent conversations next year. If you have an article you want us to highlight, make sure to send it along. I will remind you all that we have the education version of this podcast. Still one more episode left to go this year. It'll be Friday, December 27th. And again, we will be back here early in the new year, Monday, January 13th, with the clinical version of this podcast. I thank you all again for a fabulous year and look forward to nerding out more next year with you.
Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.